You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And with no time to lose, this is your Deep Dive of the Week.
Hey everyone, Nick Espinoza, your Chief Security Fanatic here. And today I am joined by Dr. Stephen Thaler. And I think this is going to be one of the most interesting and philosophical discussions that I've ever had on the air here in any which way. And Dr. Thaler, thank you so much for coming here. Should I call you Dr. Thaler or do you prefer another name?
Well, Steve will work.
Steve, that's it fine. Steve, it is. Thank you. Now, Steve, can you give basically my audience here a brief intro on who you are, what your background is, and all of that?
Well, if your profession can define you, I'm a physicist and received my PhD in that field back in 1981 from University of Missouri Columbia. Hmm. Yeah, it was basically being trained as a theoretician. Somebody said, you're not going to be making money if you do that. So I was tempted, took the bait, and became a Raman scatterer. In other words, using lasers to probe materials spectroscopically to understand the inner mechanics of what's going on. But I mixed in a lot of nuclear, laser, and solid state physics along the way. Gained an interest in what are called spin glass systems. I got interested in so-called spin glass systems, things like ferroelectrics, ferromagnetic materials, and I would freeze in memories and then computationally ramp up the temperature. And as we all know, when you start heating up a ferromagnetic or ferroelectric material, the long-range interaction between atoms tends to die off and you see a disordering effect. So I could freeze in memories of things like smiley faces. And as I raised the temperature, I'd start seeing new variations on those faces. So I could write algorithms that watched, in fact, some crude artificial neural networks that judge whether or not it was looking at a face or not. So what happened is we saw a lot of derivative faces that were forming, replacing the smiley face to begin with. And when I thought about that for a while, and I did have time because I had to go make money in a career in aerospace, but I did think about it and said, oh, wait a minute, you know, if I start turning these different would-be faces on side or upside down, they no longer look like faces. It's basically my perception at work, looking at this arrangement of bytes. So that's when I thought of using something that modeled perception, namely perceptrons, a newly arising field in artificial intelligence. So I'd basically attach a perceptron to that process to basically look for new and unusual faces out of the mix that was coming off the computer simulation. So, wow. I mean, that's how I developed the interest in neural networks. People ask, well, you know, you were in physics. What does that have to do with neural networks? Well, in the beginning, that was a very eclectic field because you had biologists, cognitive neuroscientists, you had people in physics, mathematics, computer science, and so forth. So everyone was contributing, everybody was getting involved. Quite an interesting time. But now it's more or less a formal kind of course that's taught in computer science. That's how I basically became a physicist and then transitioned over into AI and really undid a lot of the learning. I basically forget a lot of physics in the process because I say, let the neural networks theorize about what's going on and offer solutions to posed problems. So interesting. And it's really interesting to see comparatively that people devise theories over centuries regarding physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth. But the neural networks develop their own theories to account for what's going on, which is really fascinating. And that got me interested in the cognitive neuroscience, especially perception. And in particular, even beyond the perception, it was imagination. How can a neural network produce other than what it has been shown to produce before,
right?
And trained on,
right? Which I think, actually is the perfect segue into what you're doing right now, which is actually what led me to you. Now, you know, as I had mentioned to you before we started this interview here, I had read about you in Vice News and all of that about a project you've got called Daybus and what you're doing with that. And that's, I mean, I literally had to ponder that all day. The ramifications and the implications, I think, of what you're creating here is just beyond fascinating. So I'd love for you to give our audience here an understanding of what Daybus is. You know, what is this AI? What's its purpose? And what is your mission overall? Because interestingly enough, this actually started getting into the legal side of society, you know, with patents and intellectual property and all of that. So can you give us an overview of Daybus and all of that?
Well, Nick, let me start by saying what Daybus is not. I'm known for another artificial neural network architecture called a creativity machine. Mm-hmm. And that involves a mixture of two artificial neural networks, one of which is being stimulated by noise to generate new potential ideas. They're actually false memories or degraded memories that another network can look at and judge in terms of novelty, utility, or value, and deliver feedback, either ramping up the disturbances inside the generator net or ramping them down, creating an environment in which the network can memorize the ideas it's generating. So ideas are instantly converted into memories. So that is not what Daybus is. Okay. Daybus is actually a paradigm, as was the creativity machine, by the way, involving thousands of artificial neural networks, each containing its own conceptual space. I mean, it's not just one thing. They are all the things representative of a conceptual space. And they combine in a process known as bisociation. They basically combine conceptual spaces to produce whole new concepts. And that's a lot different from a creativity machine. Any kind of system that you hear about involving two neural networks that are basically doing an uphill climb toward an optimal solution are parametric optimizations that may occasionally have a twist to them that's patentable. So that is not what I'm doing. I've been doing that for the last 50 years. Daybus is entirely different in that we are not doing parametric optimizations. We are inventing conceptually. I mean, the classic example is the toothbrush. And I have worked some rather famous projects with some large companies where I'm inventing whole new toothbrush designs. That happened in 1996, I believe. But my opinion is that we really weren't inventing a toothbrush. We were doing a parametric optimization of it. The Chinese centuries ago invented the toothbrush, basically taking hog's whiskers and attaching them to a bamboo handle to create a personal dental hygiene tool. That, in my opinion, was the conceptual discovery. And in the intervening centuries, we've done a lot of materials optimization, changing geometries and so forth, material substitutions to arrive at what we consider a modern toothbrush.
So like an improvement cycle, if you will. I just want to make sure, because a good chunk of my audience also is not going to be that technical. So when I'm thinking about your optimizations as you are, let's say, looking at generation after generation of toothbrushes, what we're also talking about here is improving on the technology itself, improving on that original, you know, bamboo and you know, hog's hair design. Correct?
Well, that's correct. But the important thing here is that the system has a subjective feeling about what it is imagining. So as that happens, what happens is we've got memories that are combining. I mean, after all, if you hear some bad news, you have a series of memories going back in your past. Well, when this happened, this horrible thing happened, and a more horrible thing happened, and finally you were in danger of the ultimate danger, and namely death or illness. At the same time, you can have pleasant associations, chains of pleasant memories. I mean, here's my 8th birthday party where I really got some great presents, friends were there, and you know, grandma brought a really great big gift that I still have to this day, and feelings of life preservation and pleasantness basically abound at that point. Well, what that does in the brain is release different neurotransmitters like adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, and so forth. And those can either disrupt the idea or just tear it apart, or it can say, hey, that's a great idea. And if you look at the mathematics, what that does is chain together those ideas more permanently. Mm-hmm. So the idea basically persists, you know, and can be reawakened through the introduction of noise of different kind. But essentially, it's those chains of memories that are tantamount to sentience. And the release of neurotransmitters like that globally across cortex is what we basically call the subjective field of consciousness. And that is useful because that freezes in the more valuable these memories. And over a lifetime, what we have are cycles of the injection of neurotransmitters, the retraction of them, the neutralization of them. That's back and forth over different cycles. And guess what? That is more or less a ripening process in which the more robust of the ideas survive in the form of chains of neural networks, as opposed to pattern-based memories that you typically see coming out of me in the past. And now, you know, there are other people following my footsteps doing similar things. But again, if you watch these things in action, it looks like a flea circus with thousands or millions of fleas, and they're doing all sorts of acrobatics, interconnecting and so forth to spell out different kinds of responses in terms of geometries and topologies of things. And then it becomes a recognition game, like recognizing a sphere or a box or a pyramid and so forth in reality. Instead, you're looking at a virtual neural reality and essentially detecting when something significant is happening, like something that threatens life or something that helps to preserve and extend life. So, and that's the nature. It's basically looking at the binding trail between whole artificial neural networks, and opposed to what's going on in mainstream AI, there are no engineers that are connecting these neural networks together. They're autonomously connecting into these transient structures that symbolize different kinds of things in the world.
So that's interesting. And I there's a lot to unpack there, because I picked up on a couple of different things in terms of the sentience side of that. And that is absolutely something that I want to discuss here. But just from an overall topical standpoint, for our audience, Dabus, from what, you know, I'm understanding here, you know, from what I've read in Vice News, and I also understand that, you know, there's a few things you'd like to clarify, you know, from that article. Obviously, this is a rather complex issue. But Dabus is actually, as you have created these autonomous neural networks, has begun creating things that you are attempting to patent, in the same way that, let's say, I create a widget and I go to the U.S. Patent Office or whatever country or organization or governing body and say, I want to create this. And that has been actually causing some real consternation, because the Patent Office is basically saying, well, you know, it's not a natural person that is doing this. The case law for the U.S. Patent Office, for example, this is what I understand from what I've read, says, well, this is an artificial intelligence of some type, so it cannot be a patent holder. Am I getting that correct?
Well, I think they have used induction to say, well, this is not a human being based upon pronouns and so forth. I'm getting into legal aspects, which I really shouldn't.
Okay.
But, and that's the point that the lawyers are making is that there's nothing in the law that says that a machine can't invent. Mm-hmm. And it's such a waste, you know, there's going to be such a singularity in intellectual output by machines over the next 20 years. So that, you're going to be seeing orphaned patents and a lot of people lying about whether or not they invented something. But lying isn't uncommon. I've seen groups of people, you know, where basically it's a power struggle and, you know, somebody thinks of it and somebody more aggressive takes the reins and runs with the invention. Mm-hmm. So it happens all the time, but still there are legal consequences for anyone who falsely claims to invent something.
Right.
So well, as the rate of invention, it's not just invention, it's just scientific, technological discovery going on in all fields that you're going to be missing out. I mean, things are going to have no owners, and it's just going to turn into chaos and disorder.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a really good point in that sense, because I think it's just what you are doing. And I think what you are putting forward in, you know, the legal battle that you have here is a fascinating philosophical discussion in and of itself. You know, who or what can actually be considered creative? So for example, one of the logics that we hear about a lot is, since humans create artificial intelligence, can basically our creation be considered alive and create something unique on its own? Now, you talked about sentience in the sense that you have, let's say, a multitude of neural networks that are not being told, hey, go neural network A, go talk to neural network B. They're finding themselves and they are doing something that is wholly unique. They are creating these impressions, if you will, through chained memories and whatever other process, to basically have some kind of sentience. So by virtue of that, are we talking about, like, let's say an artificial intelligence that was originally, let's say, programmed not for one specific thing by you, for example, but to do, you know, what, hey, just do what you want to do and figure this out and see this. It kind of reminds me of what Google was experimenting with Bob, Alice, and Eve when they were looking at the encryption systems, where you had Bob and Alice talking to each other. Eve would continuously break in, attempting to find new ways to crack the encryption. And so Bob and Alice started creating a new language that basically the Google AI scientists were like, we would never have invented this on our own. And so by virtue of that, now is that a wholly owned creation of Bob and Alice, or is it because the parameters at some point, even if the parameters are completely wide open to say do what you want, is that still originating from a human? I think it's a very fascinating thing, because then we look at, you know, the future of what this looks like in terms of exactly what you're saying, people taking credit for something that they didn't necessarily create, but they created the thing that created it. And so I'm very curious to know, you know, what your thought is on that, in terms of this.
Nick, could you summarize that in one sentence? Wow, yeah, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, no, I went all over the place. So let's start here. Who or what can actually be considered creative? Since we create the AI, if the AI creates something, how is the AI being creative, even if we're programming it to think independently as we can?
Well, the point is, Davis is not being narrowed in its scope at all. It's being mentored in the same way that a human child does. So basically,
can you explain that a little bit?
Oh, I mean, you see the system going through all the stages that a toddler would. I mean, it's like they learn the primitive entities in the world, doggy, kitty, sounds like bark and meow. And then as it begins to think on its own, it begins combining different concepts together and can, you know, basically put together doggy bark, kitty meow. And of course, there is some mentorship going on. You know, you have two children, as I understand it. If they were to say at that stage of development, kitty bark, you would probably, you know, grimace and say, no, Johnny, the kitty meows, it doesn't bark. So there is some correction and mentorship going on. You might also be reading bedtime stories too, in which very complex or more complex kinds of notions are expressed. And it combines those different ideas together. But it's only after a certain point. You might say, well, they've gone to college, they've gone to grad school, and they're budding Edisons, and they think, oh, here's a complex thought, you know, running electric current through a filament of metal basically glows to produce light. And the light basically allows me to get around without killing myself in the dark in my home. So that's life preserving. And basically at that point, it is self-reinforcing because some positive goal has been reached. And that is your flooding with serotonin, dopamine, or adrenaline, or noradrenaline, whatever, that basically reinforces the bonds between those things. So it's inventing very complex concepts, not pattern-based, the union of conceptual spaces. And the point is there are revelations that go on. You know, once you reach a once you reach orbit, so to speak, then you keep going, you do some amazing things. It's all autonomous. But even then, you know, it might have been discovered some way, some time back in the past. It could have been discovered if you are a Star Trek enthusiast. It could have been invented on Vulcan long ago.
Right.
In the Star Wars world long ago. So it's really debatable whether or not something is being invented. The point is that these systems actually go beyond, you know, what they already know to create twists on what's already there. And that's what I was doing probably 30 years ago, injecting noise at just the right level that the system cannot successfully reconstruct memories. In this case, pattern-based memories, the activation patterns of neurons. In the case of Davis, it's creating a new geometry or topology between neural networks that represent an even more complex idea, oblivious to what the patterns are. But, you know, they can basically be reinforced if the trail leads to something that has salience or significance, either positively or negatively. So that would be the kind of learning that goes on all at once, as opposed to, you know, what you hear about neural networks training, you know, thousands of epochs to learn a mapping or relationship. So that is how you achieve episodic learning, wherein something really strikes you as the eureka moment, and it joins together. Yes. And I mean, I could go into great length as to how that is basically invention, but I don't think invention is really limited to human beings or even animals. I mean, my cats tend to throw things under a refrigerator, so they're repurposing the appliance as a storage location for their toys. But the universe, and I've written papers about this too, can do invention too. I mean, it's evolving, it's reinventing itself all the time. And I proposed way back in 96, I believe, this whole idea of structures forming in space because of regions separating from one another to create divides, partitions between them. And when that happens, you basically have exchange of information in a very sparse or spotty way. So one region is basically startled by what the other region is doing. And of course, the first region can be startled back. So there we have the start of cosmic consciousness.
Right.
It's certainly thinking different things than what human beings do. But you know, my claim is that these structures can form out of cosmic ingredients, utilizing things like atoms, subatomic particles, and so forth. And the mode of communication is could be photonic, photons being exchanged back and forth, or gravity being exchanged, gravitons back and forth. So yeah, you can actually produce conscious structures, and we reach a point in evolution where these systems are inventing significance to themselves. And I think that is what I called a ratcheting effect. You can't really go back because the system becomes self-preserving at that point because it has invented an illusion about itself. So it persists. And those systems are inventive. And, you know, who cares, you know, what society is saying? Well, that's not something I can use or something that's useful. It is certainly novel from the standpoint of the system. It's led to so much in the field of neurophilosophy.
Yeah,
I talk about that for 8 hours.
Honestly, I would love to. I absolutely would. It just, in the interest of time, because I, you know, this is going on the radio, so I've got a canned amount of time. I'd like to ask you one more question, though. You know, just pretty much in this vein, that as we develop these new technologies, these new neural networks and all of that, I think what one of the things that we probably have to deal with is human perception. You know what I mean? I think we've got like a hearts and minds issue here that humanity itself, I think, needs to have a paradigm shift in how we view artificial intelligence and neural networks. It kind of reminds me of studies that were done like with smart home devices like Amazon Echo. Many people say thank you, for example, to their Echo after it tells them the weather or whatever it does, even though the Echo itself has no emotional response. But you're taking it to a level where I think that is very possible. And we get emotionally attached to things, you know, just inanimate objects or whatever for nostalgic purposes, for memory imprints and all of that. But can we do, or can we feel that level of bond, let's say with an artificial intelligence like Daybus or, you know, the neural networks you've created that basically are faceless? They go beyond you know, what we conceptualize as an object in and of itself when it's a concept in execution.
They will inevitably become either friend or foe. Let me put it that way. That's what happens with any individual.
Commander Data or the Terminator.
Yeah, and that's a good example.
You know,
either way, I mean, if you're creating something human-like, and again, it's hands off. We're letting the systems organize themselves into structures that can perceive and generate ideas also. You wind up with a brain.
Steve, thank you so much for your time here. I really appreciate it. I am annoyed we're out of time, but again, thank you very much.
Nick, it's been fun. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show. Again, I don't have time for my regular exits as well. It's just been absolutely crazy. I hope you found that interview beyond fascinating, and just follow Dr. Thaler's work or Thaler's work. It is amazing, and there is a lot of cool stuff coming out. And so thank you for tuning in this week, and I'll see you next time.